I am glad for the opportunity to be able to share about this particular topic, about which I have been thinking for a while, and actually I have been writing certain articles on which basis I am actually now arranging this particular lecture today about the unfulfilled promises of the sexual revolution. And it is, I broke it in three specific parts. How do I address this particular issue? And the first one is called Interpretations Without Consensus. So that is the first one that I think when we address this particular issue of the sexual revolution, the aftermath of the sexual revolution in the last perhaps 50 years, actually almost to the date, if we go back to 1968 or something like that. Let's see how these five decades have fared under the spell of this sexual revolution, and ask some specific questions. And I'll ask this, I will put three theses, and then I will specifically ask many questions under those three subtitles. So the interpretation without consensus. In 2001, 9/11, I think that no one here present, or anyone who has been of a conscious age at that moment, would forget that particular day. 2 days before that particular date, I was on the top of one of the Twin Towers, overlooking the Hudson River, and in the distance I could see the Statue of Liberty. And then I climbed down, and 2.5 days later, that was on Saturday afternoon, on Tuesday morning, the towers were just coming down, and I was witnessing that in my live on television. I was by that time I was already in Atlanta, Georgia. So as I was seeing this particular terrible event, and I talked to a very good friend, also from the United States, on the phone, and he told me, Costa, nothing will be the same ever from this moment. Things will change radically. And if we go back to that particular moment of 9/11, and if we ask some specific questions about geopolitical policies, unanimously seen is that everyone thinks that the post-World War, Second World War, with its subtle and perfidious neocolonialism, is where we should look for the situation and the radicalism into which we found today ourselves. There is a wide consensus about this, and why, where the roots of such radicalism come from. But then, having given you such kind of image, lasting image, I believe, of one significant phenomenon that is also dictating the late 20th and the early 21st century, let us now shift our attention to another phenomenon. And I'm talking about the sexual revolution. The most known slogan would be free love, make love and not war. If you look at it, it is almost directly opposing, supposedly, the radicalism of what we have seen of 9/11 and the post 9/11 and Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria, ISIS and what's not. But when we think about its roots, where are the roots? Where the sexual revolution has actually came from? We see them as very often to be contradictorily interpreted. All of that in accord with the value system that purports a given interpretation. We are not quite sure where this has come from. And because we don't have such a specific consensus about where it really comes from, we are also at certain points at loss how to address it and what to think and what to make out of it. But let's first focus on the effects. What is one of the most specific effects of the sexual revolution? And I would claim, I would want to say, and I hope I will prove that throughout my content, is that that is the radical individualism. So that's what it is, radical individualism. We are going to define ourselves. The isolated, atomized individual is the sum of all meaning. And that's where we should look for for true meaning, and no one else outside of that nucleus, which is the ultimate nucleus, should be asked to give us any direction and to listen to any opinion. So the greatest sin in the last 5 decades has been hypocrisy. And the greatest virtue, authenticity. Be true to yourself. Have you imagined when people go public, and if they have some kind of a kind of stage fear, people tell them, be yourself. That is the worst advice you can give people. You know, when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I'm very much myself, perhaps you don't want to see me like that on a stage. So, but and nevertheless, this is it. The greatest sin is hypocrisy. The greatest virtue is authenticity. Be yourself. And not only that, you are free to be yourself, mind you, but this is now has become the new moral task. Mm-hmm. I've listened recently to a person who has struggled or engaged with this issue of sexuality on a very personal level, who said that if you look only like 50 years ago, before the sexual revolution, you would think that Christianity especially was looked as people who were with super moral, that they were extra moral people in terms of sexuality. They were faithful. But if you think about Christians today and what they think about relationship and sex, we are the immoral ones. So why? Because now the be yourself, redefine yourself radically, is the new moral task. And if it is a new moral task, this becomes a supreme anthropological ideal. So this is not something, an option. Now this has become a demand. If you want to join the future and the flourishing of the future of society, you must join this particular band and this particular worldview. So no social construct of previous coercive cultures must be left untouched and unchallenged. And any such reminiscence are by default considered to be oppressive. So no givens. If humanity some 100 years ago was basing its own survival and its own ideal of the good life on the transferred wisdom of the countless previous generations, I can compare that to similar to the matriarch in the elephant communities, where all the whole herd bases its own survival and the flourishing and the well-being of the society is based most of all on the experience of the older members of the herd, but most specifically to the matriarch, which remembers the places where you can find water and food in time of drought and all the other tricks that she then conveys to the rest of the community. Now, this particular cumulative wisdom has been considered only 50 years ago by my parents as something extremely important. Now, they are seen as folklore as best. You want to go somewhere, you want to see, just maybe 2 hours ago with my wife, as we were walking in one of the beautiful parks of Budapest, we saw a granny that was like snatched from 150 years ago from some story. That's how she was dressed completely. And she looked, you know, very appealing. But the thing is that we see all of these things, not only her dress, but everything that perhaps comes with her worldview, now we see only as quaint, sweet folklore that you look at, but at the same time, you think it's not very important. So how I can relate this particular development and aftermath of the sexual revolution, I would call it as a new Gnosticism. Why do I call it a new Gnosticism? If you go back and look at the classical understanding of what in the second half of the first century after Christ AD, and we look at that development of Gnosticism, we'll see that the idea is that an evil demiurge has created material world, including the bodily existence, the physical existence of human beings. And this physical world is really a prison for the spirit. So in order to release from these physical fetters the human spirit or mind has to recognize the illusory base material creation in order to access the sublime spiritual existence. When a great expert on Gnosticism and someone who has published the Gnostic Gospels, Elaine Pagels, speaks on this topic, I think she says more than she wants to tell us, more than she wants to openly say what she means. Because according to Elaine Pagels, Gnosticism is a religion for the elite, for the learned, indeed, for the literati. The Gospel of Thomas promises salvation to astute interpreters, quote now of the Gospel, whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings will not taste that. Gnosticism, you see, is for the elite, for the special chosen capable elite to penetrate through the opaqueness and the baseness of the material in order to reach out into the light, ethereal, spiritual world. And N.T. Wright, I think, rightly pinpoints that and says that this is the leading mode of the Western modern world. Modern Gnosticism, the material, the physical, and the given by default now are not seen as a gift, are not seen as a means, are not seen as an asset or as a resource. Now they are simply seen as a burden, or at worst, or as a kind of open source at best, that you can do whatever you want with. So nature is not any longer your friend in the 21st century. That brings us naturally from Gnosticism, we go into the direction of dualism, because Gnosticism by definition is dualistic. And what dualism really do is basically makes an ontological distinction between the created order, and one order is holy, untouched, and unblemished, and the other order is simply base and fallen and sinful. Now, I believe that both extremes of dualism are the same, are the two sides of the same coin. Why do I say this? Well, it is a pure logic if you think about that. You can go in two possible directions based on the same premises. Physical, material, bodily is evil and is illusory. Therefore, is completely worthless. So what do you do with worthless things? Well, you can do whatever you want with worthless things. Therefore, one in one direction, if you go, we can treat the bodily whichever we want. We can be licentious, we can be promiscuous, we can do whatever we want, as long as we understand that beneath that, behind that, beyond that, we have something which is specifically spiritual. And then, of course, the other extreme is the assumption that the illusory and the material shall be put under rigorous control of the spiritual. So the material will wither in order for the spiritual to flourish. What is that? It's called gnosis. It's called knowledge. And the only way of getting to it is by a deep look into one's inner being. Now, where do we see the most prominent demonstration of modern Gnosticism today, is my question. You have guessed it already. In the aftermath of the sexual revolution. So the bodies we are born in, sex included, are open for any interpretation and redefinition. Just to give you a few, these are the most bizarre, but still, if you always want to make a point out of an argument, you bring it to its own logical extreme in order to see whether it obtains or it doesn't. So I'll give you a few examples of this. We have a story of a biological man of, I think was in his late 40s, early 50s. He was father of 7 children. And then suddenly he left his family to live a transgender life as a 6-year-old girl. And he was adopted by a family. And you can see photos of him sitting on a floor, playing with 2 dolls, dressed in a girlish dress and having, how do you call these things? Ponytails. If that is not bizarre too much, there is a woman from one of the Nordic countries, from Scandinavia. She is a biological woman, but she thinks she's of a feline species. She was born in the wrong species. So she feels that she should be allowed to be accepted you know, as a self-definition that she's feline. And then the ultimate of all is a young man who has gone countless and countless operations to come to the point of believing that his destiny is to have a life of non-sexed alien. But people are now even trying to say that they cannot decide, and some people are recently asking even for a further possibility of speaking. I think there are around 71 or 73 genders that you can choose from currently. And if that is not bizarre enough, a man from Amsterdam in the Netherlands, maybe a few days ago, has been asking that he will change formally, that he can change his birth date for 20 years. He says if people are transgender, if they can change their sex, and I feel that I cannot have a decent date because when I say I'm 68, nobody wants to talk to me. When I say I'm 48, everybody wants to talk. So I'm going to change my age. There you go. Because ageism, it's called ageism, right? Yeah. And what is that? I think Woody Allen, some 20 years ago, has defined it for all of us. What is this all about? Well, his life has been so complicated. He's lived with Mira Farrow. But at the moment, he's married to one of his adopted children with Mira Farrow. So it's really complicated. By the time when it was really, really hot in the press, the whole situation some 20 years ago, they asked him this question, why did you do that? After explaining that all it was fine and legal, this is what Woody Allen says. The heart wants what it wants. That's it. Mm-hmm. A radical self-definition, radical individualism, and radical possibility that nothing given must stay. All needs to be double-checked. So that's one number one. The second point that I want to address with the sexual revolution is facing reality. Reality has this unyielding habit to be what it is. Reality unravels our constructed realities. I can feel the sting in the tail of this comment. Reality unravels our constructed realities. One of the favorite words about constructed whatever identities and etc. etc. So let us think of a concrete statistic reality. What has were the promises of the sexual revolution? Promises that there will be much bigger enjoyment of sex, more frequent sex, that there will be humanity will be more satisfied, more fulfilled. And numerous researchers today show that simply is not true. If anything, we have less sex. People show that they have less satisfaction from their sexual life. And they feel increasingly lonely. The problem of loneliness. In New York Post, in 2017, there was an article which says that to live as a single carries higher index of mortality than obesity currently. Sure. And supposedly in the States, obesity is a big, 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 big thing. So living as a single, unwanted single life carries higher index of mortality than obesity. And who suffers the most? There are quite extensive researches on this, and I'm summarizing them with two words. Usually the most vulnerable. Who are these? Children and elderly. So we want our lives, and who suffers is usually those who really need, who are the most vulnerable in such situations. In England, I distributed newspapers to make some living while I was doing my doctorate. So every morning, 6 days a week, I would just do the 20 kilometers of cycling and tossing newspapers into people's mailboxes. So, and there was one man who was at that time in his mid-80s. And he was every morning, the moment I was arriving to pick up my rounds in order to deliver, he would show up to pick up his newspaper. And obviously, he was defeating the purpose of my work because he was coming to pick up his own newspaper. And I'm so glad there were no more than like him. But anyhow, that's another story. And I asked the owner, who was a Pakistani person, and they couldn't, they lived in the UK for maybe 30 years and they still couldn't understand what these British are all about. especially when it comes to extended family and friendship. And I said, why is this man every morning coming? Rain or snow or whatever, he comes. He says, you know what, Costa? If he doesn't come to pick up this newspaper in the morning, he will not see another human being the next 24 hours. And that was like shocking. A wife of a dear friend, actually, both of them. She's a dear friend as well. Before they moved to Oxford and he did his doctorate and she's continued with her life of arts, she worked as a nurse, as a visiting nurse in London. And she told me about one such kind of incident, let's call it. They kept visiting an elderly lady who lived alone with a very innocent wound they needed to tend. And they fixed it, they did all that there is to be done in order for the wound to heal, and there was all probabilities that the wound will heal. So they come next, whatever our appointment was, they look at the wound, if anything, it's actually worsened. A week later, it gets even worse and it deteriorates. And they're thinking, something, you know, nothing here shows us that this should be going on. And nevertheless, it happens. Until they cornered the old lady, so metaphorically speaking, and she spoke back and she said she's been digging into her wound on purpose so that there will be the only people who will visit her on a weekly basis would be the nurses from the hospital. So that's, it's staggering when you look at the facts. Do we have eyes to see? That is the most important question. Glyn Harrison, a formerly professor and head of Department of Psychiatry, University of Bristol, has written a spectacularly beautiful book from which I also draw a lot here, and it's called A Better Story. And not only that, he said the ideological engines of the sexual revolution have failed in their general social promises, but basically they have failed to alleviate many other ailments they promised it will alleviate. So let's think about the promise to annul social division between families. Society has not been divided as it is now some 60 years ago. And Glyn Harrison quotes Robert Putnam and his book, Our Children, The American Dream in Crisis, says that the average difference between children who will hear between two children from two different families, one from a middle-class family, the other one from let's say, a working or a poor family, before or by the age they reach school age, which in the United States is perhaps like 4 or 5 years, I don't know, 5 years maybe age or so. Do you know what is the difference these two children will hear in these years? 19 million words. That's the difference. When those two children come to school, one of them has heard 19 million more words than the other. Tell me about disadvantage. Tell me about how you begin your academic life. How do you make up for lack of 19 million words? What is the irony? The irony is that the rich, the popular, the able, and the successful are telling every one of us that we need to believe nothing, we need to check everything, and we need to restructure everything. Who hears this and who follows it almost blindly? It is the poor and the destitute. So that, the irony of all ironies, the marriage has become the privilege of the rich. Those who are at the same time trying to tell us that we should discard it. Where we should look for the sources of all of that? One of these sources is definitely to look into the Enlightenment and the post-Enlightenment era of radical atheism. One of such is the Bolshevik Revolution, for example. So what the Bolshevik Revolution did basically is to look at anything that they thought it was bourgeois and dismantle it. One of these things was the marriage too. They committed themselves to destroy marriage. I visited one country of the former Soviet bloc. And coming from a former Yugoslavia, where really I can say the family was not disintegrated, far from that, during socialism, I was utterly and absolutely shocked, not prepared for what I actually witnessed. There were billboards all over the place in that big city of that post-Soviet country, in which basically said, when you are divorced, your children are not ex-children, are your ex-spouse. And that was referring to the responsibility of divorced people, divorced parents, to have to continue to look for their children. Most of the time what happens is that children are not wanted by any of the parents and they end up in a state institution. They say in this particular country that the average is 70% a month of divorces to every of the total number of marriages. And some months it reaches 80%. What has the sexual revolution promised? Happy lives, stable individuals. But what we have is that children reared in a stable marriage far better than any other context. Full stop. That is reality for you. What about gay and lesbian relationships? They are most volatile, especially the homosexual ones. They say one research shows that 41.3% of partners have non-monogamous sex outside the relationship, not protected. 10 of them lived in an open sex relationship. These are 51.3% of the partnerships. Those are people who speak to each other. The other 50% are not even putting any agreements. So the number of those people who live in such open sexual relationships is perhaps staggering. Compare this with 85% of faithfulness, monogamy with married women, and 75% for married men. And the percentages just cannot compare them. So that's the second point. And then the final and the third one is an experiment without a safety net. So we're talking about freedom without boundaries. Well, when you have a freedom without boundaries, actually you have fear. When you have freedom without boundaries, you have fear. George Monbiot, a columnist, a syndicate columnist for The Guardian, says in one of his articles, though our well-being is inextricably linked to the lives of others, everywhere we are told that we will prosper through competitive self-interest and extreme individualism. Further in the article he writes, as Rhiannon Lucy Costlett has brilliantly documented, girls and young women routinely alter the photos they post to make themselves look smoother and slimmer. Mm-hmm. Today we took a selfie with my wife. So when you take a photo, a regular photo, it gives you the regular settings. The moment you make a selfie, what does it do? It puts you on a beautify. Immediately, the phone knows what you need. Some boosting your self-confidence. Ha ha, I look much more beautiful. Welcome, he says, I quote him again, welcome to the post-Hobbesian dystopia, a war of everyone against themselves. And if someone thinks this is an exaggerated fact, a recent survey in England suggests that 1 in 4 women between 16 and 24 have harmed themselves, and 1 in 8 now suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. Phobias, obsessive-compulsive disorder, 26% of the women in this age group. This is what public crisis really looks like. So the pressure of self-define and self-affirm are damaging our generation of youth. LGBT movement claims that the norms, what is normal and what is acceptable, must not conform to outside pressure. But these are all kind of steadfast statistics that no one is looking at and reckon with. What is this now group doing is, I would claim that what every group throughout history, human written history of society, recorded history, has always done. Once you get to a real power, the emphasis on a real power in society, what do you do? I think Foucault was right for one thing. You want, who controls the language, controls everything else. So what happens? Language is banned in such way so that it's clearly defined who are the victims and who are the villains. And then we go back to Christian values. 60, 70 years ago, Christianity was too moral. 70 years later, Christian values of relationships are claimed immoral and oppressive. This is case in point in the academia. Because if you went 70 years back or 60 years back in the academia and you looked at the language that sometimes they used,
You can take the same language, you can quote something that is happening 50 years ago that was perhaps for minorities, let's say for gay, let's say for people of color, but now you take these sentences by the professors nowadays, they can almost be quoted word for word, but now they're applied to all of those who disagree with them, for those minorities and those views. So I'm not trying to say that it's wrong to actually look for equality and look for the right justice and relationship within society. What I'm trying to say that human heart always wants to go to the extreme once they get to the point of power. It is the, you know, the second line, if I may say, of the golden rule. You know, the golden rule is do to everybody what do you want them to do to you. But the second line of a golden rule in this context seems to me to be that who's got the gold makes the rules. Basically, who's got the power is making the rules of what is now right and what is now wrong. Take Yale University, English department, 2016 and 17. They petitioned to ban Saussure, Spencer, Shakespeare, Donne, Milton, Pope, Wordsworth, and Eliot. Why? Because the students, all of them 18 and 19 year old, wanted to decolonize English literature and advocated instead to be studied more women and men from other continents. The author Katie Waldman comments for the magazine Slate. Here is the thing though. If you want to become well-versed in English literature, you're going to have to hold your nose and read a lot of white male poets. Like a lot. We know that the movement for human rights, we know for the Declaration of the United Nations about human rights is something that we must value as a ultimate gift to humanity. We can think of Martin Luther King and what a gift he has been to the modern world. But at the same time, we need to think the appeal for equality and inclusivity assumes that there are no objective, rational, moral, and social limits. Everything is for grabs. Tiny minority that uses ideology to justify the radical individualization, gender perspective, and wants to pressurize it from the earliest age. So supposedly 3 years old in a kindergarten should be aware of a gender perspective. Yeah. Young children are guinea pigs of a social experiment, not being subjected to rigorous law norms. Just try to do any of these things that are suggested and pushed and approved and applauded and lauded in the sexual or whatever personal relationships. Try to apply a fraction of this to a banking or a finance sphere. Do you know what they'll think? That you're utterly mad. They will look for an institution for you the moment you suggest such a thing. People are extremely careful in the choice of their business partner when joining their resources for profit. It is incredible that such care is absent when choosing a lifestyle. More so, to be careful in this sphere of life is considered oppressive and harmful. Roland J. Lowther, an Australian who writes a blog on similar issues, summarizes the teaching of social anthropologist J.D. Unwin, who tells us that history teaches us, especially on society level, that giving up one thing in favor of another new thing is never without consequences. It's no way that you do something without actually bringing some certain consequence. So we need to be aware of that. Unwin reminds us, I quote him, "The smallest change in the fundamental principle of a social law will revolutionize the social tradition." But then he says, every social tradition has energy. And his findings unequivocally show that the standard monogamous heterosexual marriage, and this is written in the late 30s, produces the highest level of social energy, and that any kind of social liberalization or widening of this worldview resulted with lowering of its energy, followed by a decline from its economical and political rise. And I think, as I'm ending on this note, this is something that I suggest as a way of a discourse for the contemporary world. Obviously, we have so many things to say that are based in the Bible. We have so many things to claim, because if we believe in God and we know that God is the sum of all good, of all knowledge, of all understanding, the best thing to be is to follow his decrees. But at the same time, I want to say that before we are even able to go there, which is very important, and I don't want for one split second to undermine that, I would like to say we need to have an audience. If the audience, if the audience is not open to listen to what we want to tell them, what is moral and what is good, it's just, there is no way how we can tell them the real thing. So, therefore, one of the things I suggest is to do something which Jesus did with, I mean, masterfully. None of us can do it, but we can try, attempt to do a bit of it. And what is it? Ask good questions. Good questions have the habit of making people give good answers and face with reality when they're wrong. So, on that end, I finish.